We're going to go on to talk about future shock, but I thought we'd start by looking at false flag operations, because this is one of the things we're getting in this future shock world, is we don't get a chance to disentangle ourselves or to understand one terrorist attack or one major international event before the next one's right on top of us.
No, but I mean, obviously most people who are regular listeners to this show will understand the concept of a false flag attack. And of course there's overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have and still are engaging in such attacks.
It really comes from naval warfare, I believe.
Well, originally the term comes from naval warfare, but a false flag means that you at sea, before modern communications, you could only tell what ship was by looking at its flag. So if you run up a different flag, they think it's that it looks like
they'll come in close and blow you to pieces,
yeah,
when you think
but
it's
but
your
course,
own side.
Ultimately, it's become a standard tactic.
One of the warning signs of false flag operations, some very good articles about this. There's an immediate comprehensive narrative, including a convenient culprit. The official narrative has obvious domestic and geopolitical advantages for the governing body. The narrative behind the attack serves to leverage emotions like fear as well as the patriotism in order to manufacture consent around a previously controversial issue. And finally, Martin, the military training drills and police drills occur on the day and very near the attack itself, causing confusion to obscure eyewitness testimony and allowing orchestrators to plant both patsies, disinformation and backup operatives.
Well, that's a pretty good summary.
So let's have a listen now to a clip from Future Shock, and then we'll discuss that briefly.
Flight number 341 will be arriving at gate 7.
In the course of my work, which takes me to just about every corner of the globe, I see many aspects of a phenomenon which I'm just beginning to understand. Our modern technology has achieved a degree of sophistication beyond our wildest dreams, but this technology has exacted a pretty heavy price. We live in an age of anxiety, a time of stress, and with all our sophistication, we are, in fact, the victims of our own technological strength. We are the victims of shock, of future shock.
Future shock is a sickness which comes from too much change in too short a time. It's the feeling that nothing is permanent anymore. It's the reaction to changes that happen so fast that we can't absorb them. It's the premature arrival of the future. For those who are unprepared, its effects pretty devastating.
That's Orson Welles there, the 1972 film Future Shock. Thoroughly recommend it. Martin, look, we're in this situation where the technology has advanced. It should have provided humanity with vast amounts of leisure time, but it hasn't. It's meant that we're working far, far harder than we were back in the 60s and 70s.
Well, in that era, I remember it well, we talked about the possibility of how we were going to deal with all the leisure we were going to get. Seems laughable now.
So why didn't we get it?
We didn't get it because the ruling classes were never going to let us have it. The problem is that the system we live under, the capitalist system, which is based on private profit, cannot provide those things without substantial reform.
You said it yourself. Capitalism died in 2008.
Actually. Well, yeah, we've now got socialism for the rich. They're being propped up by the taxpayer. So that's what's going on, basically. They're willing to spend money on themselves, but they're not willing to spend money on us. But when you've got people like Bill Gates saying, well, you know, within 10 to 15 years, everything is going to be automated, everything, literally everything, then you'll see what the problems are going to be. And ultimately, we're going to have a redistribution of wealth in favour of the majority on this planet. It's an inevitable thing, but there's going to have to be a huge fight about it, because those with the haves do not want to share with
but
the have-nots.
Surely we can do this through the political system by voting in some kind of fair system. It's obviously quite not quite
obviously,
fair at the
obviously better to do it through a democratic process, but don't forget, in many countries, democracy is hardly there. I mean, Dilma Rousseff has just been removed as the president of Brazil by in a legalistic coup, and that has actually knocked back 30 years of progress for the underclass in Brazil. We constitute tens of millions of people, and they're about to lose everything that they've gained over that period through a coup.
So,
and
if what
do you do about that? Well, you have to resist it somehow, but it's not necessarily through voting, is it?
So, if the representation of the people, democracy, is on its knees, who's really running things?
Well, the democracy has always been a work in progress, even in the most supposedly democratic countries.
Who's running things?
It's run by the financial oligarchy and their military allies in the secret services and the military industrial complex. They're armed, they're dangerous, they're greedy, and they're in power. And they'll have to be stopped, just as Hitler had to be stopped in the 1940s. But there's going to be bloodshed. There already is bloodshed. 60,000 casualties the Syrian army's taken in the last 4 years. And that's the price that people have to pay.
No chance of doing this through the ballot box?
Well, it depends where you are and who you are. It's all circumstance and possibilities, isn't it? In Bahrain, they can't vote. Maybe they'll have to have an uprising. And, of course, in Syria, the British position has been that people who take up arms against the government are justified. You could question that. But that's the British position in Syria. But not in Egypt, not in Saudi Arabia, not in Bahrain. There, people have just got to knuckle down. But in Syria, we've got our own special forces training them to have to blow things up and kill the enemy. And, of course, Britain believes in that. We're not pacifists. We believe in armed struggle, don't we?
So
David Cameron believes in it.
So is everything that we get in the press about how decisions are made, is that theatre?
Yes. Frankly, it is. I mean, many people around the world are very well aware it's theatre. It's self-regarding nonsense, really. Britain has gone all... I mean, we support the government of Bahrain, which is repressing its people at the minute, and we're going to build a new military base there with our taxes. Now, if you were a Bahraini patriot, you could draw the conclusion that we're going to have to fight these people, and that means fighting the British. So any British military personnel who are sent to Bahrain, to the military base that the people don't want there, if somebody blows their head off, well, I'm afraid that's just the way it will have to be. Not that the people in Bahrain are calling for armed struggle, they're not, but they're morally justified in adopting armed struggle if they chose to do so.
Manfred Petrisch is a former Swiss investment banker. He's turned rogue, now running a blog called All Smoke and Mirrors in German, where he dishes the dirt on Henry Kissinger, the Bilderbergers and the global elite. He explained to me earlier this week how he realised we're being ruled by a criminal elite.
My name is Manfred Petrisch, but I go under on my blog, which I've been running for nearly 15 years, alternative media blog. And I've been watching the Bilderbergers now since about 2004, and have gone to their meetings in Europe, and I can compare the different meetings that have happened and how, for instance, the security has progressed. I mean, when I saw them first, there was hardly any security. They have come and the watches have increased over the last years. What has happened is that we have forced the Bilderbergers to come out into the open and start their own website and give out information. And also that the media has, I can remember times a few years ago when they said there is no such thing as Bilderberg, that we are inventing things. But now at least they are saying that they exist, but of course they are saying it's a harmless meeting and things like that.
Okay, so why the Bilderberg? Why have you decided to follow them?
First of all, if you do research on the Bilderbergs, and it was created in the beginning of the 50s, 53, 54, and you see also the people behind that, then you notice that there is a very close connection between the transatlantic movement, NATO, EU, and all these things, all the people are involved in that, and also that the CIA was one of the main creators of the European movement and unification. And this all intertwines, and also when you then research Prince Bernhard, that he was 100% Nazi, that he was in the NSDAP, he was in the SS, I find it very strange that this group then claims to for itself that they made the decision to create the EU, that they made the decision to create the European Common Currency and things like that. So obviously these are people who make important decisions, but the media never reports anything about it. I mean, it's completely hidden. And that's why I was curious to find out what's going on there, and that's why I went to their meetings.
Right. I mean, what about IG Farben? Because this is another part of the thing that Bernhard was involved in. I don't think many people in Britain really understand what it was. I think it was some kind of cartel that was involved in manufacturing weapons and explosives.
Well, IG Farben was the biggest chemical company in Europe. It was a huge company that was involved in all these chemical works, you know, anything that had to do with chemical manufacturing. And it was then broken up into different companies after the war, out of which then Bayer evolved and also Hoechst evolved and different other chemical companies. But up to the end of the war, it was a huge conglomerate of chemical companies, which created all sorts of chemical products. And one of them was the one that used in the concentration camps.
IG Farben was a cartel. It was a cartel. The thing that fascinated me when I first came across these Bilderbergs was that it was the main cartel guy in the United States, the oil cartel, the family from Standard Oil Cartel, that decided that they wanted to get involved in Bilderberg too. That's the Rockefeller family. And I wonder if you think that that's just pure coincidence, that these two families from Germany and companies from Germany and the United States, who are both into this kind of idea of no competition capitalism, found themselves conjoined at the Bilderberg conferences.
Well, we know that at close to the end of the war, the main heads of big German companies who knew that the war was lost were thinking how to continue after the war. So what they did was they made a lot of plans and also saved a lot of things for the aftermath of the war. And this whole thing continued. You see, the Nazis just didn't disappear. They just evolved, put on a mask, and continued in a different way. And one of the ways they did it is that they said, well, we'll create this common market, and we will then dominate Europe through the economy and not through the Wehrmacht, not through the army. But in end effect, they did the same thing, and that's how this was actually evolved into this union, which began as an economic union. Now, we know that the big owners of corporations in America always supported the Nazis. I mean, that they financed them, and that's why this relationship goes back a long time. You know, and that's why, of course, this transatlantic bridge was built, which Rockefeller was one of the main builders, and that's why he was involved then in the Bilderbergers together with Henry Kissinger, and that's the Bilderbergers is basically this transatlantic bridge between America and Europe to make sure that Europe is always connected to America and not the other way towards Russia. I mean, they hate Russia. And that's why they want to keep Europe always bound to America.
It sounds a bit like, almost like the Cold War, but it's not just the Cold War, is it? Because the hatred of Russia seems to go back beyond that. I mean, right the way back to Napoleon, Manfred.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the hate for Russia goes back to the 19th century. So it's an old hatred. And you see, the biggest nightmare for these elites is a union or a cooperation between Germany and Russia. I mean, that's their nightmare. And that's why they do everything that this doesn't happen.
Is there anything that you gain particularly from this particular Bilderberg conference? Of course, you are, I think, Swiss German, so you might, as a half German anyway, have some kind of better insight than most people as to the significance of the conference this year.
Well, from an optical point of view, a watcher point of view, there's a big difference to, for instance, last year. last year when we were in tariffs in Tirol, in Austria, we were separated by nearly 10 kilometers distance between the hotel and where we could be. That means last year there was a huge security perimeter, and we couldn't even see the hotel if we were so far away. And therefore we could not take any photos of the people at the hotel. We only caught them at the airport, arrival day and on the departure day. That's where we caught them, you know, when they were landing with their planes or taking off with their planes. Now this time in Dresden, we were very close to them because it was in the middle of the city, and we got nearly an overdose of pictures of them. For me, selecting Dresden as the meeting venue is for me in a total provocation. First of all, because it is the city where the Pegida is most, you know, was created and is most active. And to select this city in the east of Germany, which is most opposed gegen the migration and most opposed gegen all the policies of Merkel and also of the EU, means for me it is a provocation. And also that they did it so openly that we could see a lot means that they are just arrogant. And we also saw this in this catwalk when they walked from the hotel over to the castle where they had their dinner on Saturday. I mean, for me, this was also a total provocation towards us, right? They're telling us, you guys have nothing to say. You're just sitting behind a fence. You cannot touch us. We are protected by the police, and you guys have to pay it with taxpayer money. Arrogance.
There's also the fact that many of these people that rule the NATO countries, and it'd be interesting to see if you think they do rule the NATO countries, they are completely anonymous. They can walk down the street and nobody even recognizes them.
That's right. I mean, that's true. A normal person wouldn't recognize the boss of, let's say, Google or of Airbus or of Deutsche Bank or whoever was there. I mean, they were really the top shots of the big corporations, world banks, world oil companies, and generals and former CIA bosses, etc. They were all there. And it's ridiculous for the media to tell us that this is just a harmless meeting. Because if you look at the people who meet there, they all have power in their respective areas. And they don't come together and fly halfway around the world just to meet for 4 days and then talk about the weather or something. But that's what they're telling us.
So, okay, so if you could be a fly on the wall, what's really going on in there?
Well, definitely we know that what happens is that they invite experts in certain areas. They give speeches. They give talks. So what happens is that the Bilderbergers are informed about the latest developments in certain areas, like, for instance, in the IT area, in the information gathering area, or in military area, or in other political things. They are informed so that they have the latest information about what's going on. That's the one thing that happens in there. And the second thing, of course, is that in their discussions, they come to some sort of a unified thinking, and maybe even decisions are made, although they say there no decisions are made, but that's, you know, for the naive people. What happens then is that with this latest information and also plans about the future, they go back home into their relevant areas and execute then with this know-how whatever plans that they have been given.
Okay, so what plans have they been given?
Well, we can only guess according to the themes that were handled, you know, like the one big theme was, of course, Russia, China, then EU migration policy, unification and things like that. We know from past experiences or past meetings that something has happened. What was very interesting is that the head of the Supreme Commander of NATO was there, Breedlove, and also the former five-star general Petraeus and CIA boss. And it's interesting that 2 days after Bilderberg, NATO announced in Brussels that a cyber attack by any country against a NATO member will be handled the same way as a military attack in the real world. That means a cyber attack against one of the NATO members will automatically release Article 5 of the NATO agreement, which means defense. That's very interesting that it was announced just 2 days after Bilderberg. Obviously, that's one thing that could have been discussed there to give NATO a reason for war. For instance, if they declare Russia has done a cyber attack on us, which is equivalent to a military attack, then they can respond. That means that's a reason for war.
Fascinating. I mean, in a way, maybe some of the most interesting research on the Bilderberg is not actually at the conference, but it's what some of the key players are saying after the conference.
Of course, yes. And also, which persons make sudden career moves. I mean, we have watched it very often. One typical example is Bill Clinton, who went to Baden-Baden in, when was it, 91, yeah. He went as a completely unknown governor of Arkansas. He went to Baden-Baden Bilderberg meeting, and then 2 years later he was president of the United States. I mean, that's an incredible career move.
A German who was at the conference I spoke to, he said that he approached somebody who was friendly with one of the Bilderberg members, who was the director of the Hamburg Peace Studies Institute, and he spoke to him about it. And this is Klaus Kopf I spoke to, and you can find this interview online. It's Bilderberg Exposed in Dresden, number 2, I think. And he explains that this guy said to him, "You naive, blue-eyed asshole, do you think that the American president is really voted in?" No, you know, and I wonder what you make of that statement by someone who was apparently in the know, and what Bilderberg really means for democracy. Because I know one of the police said at the Bilderberg conference, when we were chatting to them, he said, "Oh, does that mean that it doesn't make any difference who we vote for?"
Yeah, well, that's for sure, because we know that 2008, Hillary and Obama were at the Bilderberg conference in Washington and in Chantilly, and that the whole press corps was sent on an April Fool's thing to Chicago to distract them, and they came in through the back door, and that obviously at the Bilderberg meeting, Obama was selected as the president and Hillary was given the second prize, so to say, as a foreign minister. So this happened 2008. Now, we always knew this, but we could not prove it. And 2 years ago, the French prime minister was confronted with this question, and he confirmed this. He confirmed that and said, yes, this is how it happened. So what we presumed before was confirmed by the French Prime Minister.
Now, Manfred, tell us a bit about yourself, because you're actually in Abkhazia now, on the Black Sea, which is an interesting place to be. But you're originally, I think, from Switzerland.
That's right. I mean, I used to work more than 30 years in the financial business for in investment banking. And by the way, one of my customers was in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. And that's why I got involved to this whole 9/11 research, because I asked my customer after 9/11 what he experienced. And he told me that there was a big explosion coming from the basement before the first plane hit. And this, of course, when he told me this as a witness, kind of completely made me skeptical about the official story, right? So I did a lot of research, and this is actually how I got into this whole alternative media and truth movement, if you can say it that way, because of 9/11. And once I started getting into this whole research, I found so many discrepancies and things that are not true about the official story about 9/11. And then the whole thing happened with the Iraq war. I mean, this hysteria about attacking Saddam Hussein and creating this lie about weapons of mass destruction also made me then think, what the hell is going on? Why are they doing this? You know, lying us into wars. And then I found out that nearly every war is based on lies. I mean, the Vietnam War is based on lies about the Gulf of Tonkin incident that never happened, right? And things like that. So I got more and more involved into the whole history of our world and how wars have been conducted and how they've been sold to us, and so this is how I got into this whole thing.
You're from a Swiss German family who obviously were quite close to that Second World War. I mean, that wasn't orchestrated, was it?
Well, of course, in a way it was. I mean, we know that, for instance, Churchill did everything to bring America into the war. They did the same thing as in the First World War. You see, in the First World War, England and France had lost 1917. I mean, the Germans had won the war, they beat the Russians on the East Front, moved all the troops to the Western Front, and they beat the British and the French. What happened was that through the Balfour Declaration, the whole it was promised that the Americans would get into the war, and that of course turned the table. And the same thing happened with the Second World War, right? I mean, but that would be a huge long story if we go into the First and Second World War.
Well, it's also worth pointing out that a lot of money for Hitler came from Wall Street, for example.
Well, that's what I said before. And don't forget that, for instance, the Americans knew perfectly well that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor because they were reading all their communication, and they definitely let it happen. They let it happen so that they could give themselves away as victims and then declare the war, because up to Pearl Harbor, the American public was totally against involvement in the Second World War. They were isolationists, and so they needed this Pearl Harbor thing to happen. And by the way, 9/11 was also declared by George W. Bush to be the second Pearl Harbor. You need these attacks against yourself to be able to do your wars that you want.
So what's the point of it all, Manfred?
The world domination, of course. I mean, the whole point of the American aggressiveness is world domination, and every country which does not bow down and follow the orders which come from America is declared an enemy, right? I mean, this applies to China, to Iran, to Russia, to any country that does not bow down to the imperialistic dictatorship of the elite, who does not accept a multipolar world. They want a unipolar world where they dominate everything.
Well, yes, that's so, I mean, you know, you've just recently moved to Abkhazia on the Black Sea from Switzerland. Now, Switzerland is seen as a neutral, safe haven. Two world wars have happened around Switzerland, and I just see the Swiss bankers as kind of sitting on top of their mountains with the binoculars watching the war going on and counting the money coming in. But you've moved to the Black Sea, which is almost like, potentially anyway, kind of ground zero in any kind of future conflict between NATO and Russia. So why have you gone from this kind of safe haven in Switzerland to somewhere which is potentially a bit of a hot potato?
Well, I'm sorry, I have to completely destroy your illusions. First of all, Switzerland is not a safe haven. Secondly, our politicians in Switzerland are exactly the same traitors like in all the EU countries. They would sell Switzerland to Brussels in 5 minutes if they could. And that's why our head of parliament, the president of the Swiss parliament, was in Dresden at the Bilderberg meeting. I also talked to her for 2 hours after the meeting. That means, you see, for me, when the Bilderberg meeting in 2011 was in Switzerland, I realized by watching what was happening and organizing the protests there, that we have lost the game. We have lost the game. And that the politicians have nothing to say. They have nothing to say. They're all controlled by the big, huge corporations. And we have the problem that they have all the power. They own the military, they own the media, they own the police, they own the judges, they own the all the powers that you need. And we on the other side, we own nothing. So we have lost. And also that there is this absolutely hysterical drive to make war with Russia. I mean, we see this in the last years, how they have been bashing Russia and Putin like hell. And they also moved all their troops and their weapons towards the Russian border. They have now installed this so-called anti-ballistic rocket system in Romania, which they're telling us are against rockets of Iran and North Korea, which is a laugh. Now, you said before that I moved into an area which could be a potential target. No. The potential target is Europe. Europe will be flattened in a future war. Not Russia or America. Europe will be flattened again. And I tell this to all my German friends. I tell them, do you realize that because of all the American military bases there, all the command centers in Germany, AFRICOM, CENTCOM, and all these bases, and also that you have atomic weapons stored in Germany, that you are a prime target for a war? That the first thing that will be hit is Germany? Because that's where all the Americans have their bases. And all wars come from German territory.
Well, hang on a minute, because you've just talked about CENTCOM and AFRICOM. What are they and where are they based? We don't hear about them in the news.
Well, that doesn't mean they don't exist. I mean, CENTCOM and AFRICOM, for instance, the center is in Stuttgart. That's the command center for all the military operations which are done in Africa and in the Middle East. It's all controlled from Stuttgart, the big military base there and command center there. The same applies to, for instance, Rammstein. From Rammstein, all the killer drones are controlled, which fly over Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan and North Africa, wherever they fly around and kill people. They're all controlled from Rammstein, this huge Air Force base there. And Wiesbaden is the big European military center command. You see, there are over 70,000 American troops based in Germany. 70,000 American soldiers occupying Germany. That's the most occupying force in the whole of the world. Well, more than in Japan or more than in South Korea.
And more than in Britain. But anyway, I mean, there is an agreement, isn't there, which was signed, I think it was around about 1990, is it called the 4+1 or the 4+2 agreement, which says that no NATO troops are allowed anywhere into Eastern Germany?
Yeah, so that's not true. For instance, Leipzig, which is not far away from Dresden, is the biggest airport where all the American troops land and then continue to wherever war front they are sent to. If they're sent to Afghanistan or sent to some other war zone, they all come through Leipzig. Nearly every third passenger there is a soldier.
What about your experience in investment banking? Because this is a bit of a kind of smoke-filled rooms world that most people don't have any kind of idea about, Manfred. What does your experience there tell you about the whole global financial situation, particularly since 2008?
Well, first of all, the Swiss investment banking, or generally the Swiss banking system, has been destroyed. It doesn't exist anymore. It only exists in Hollywood films or in James Bond films. But in reality, there is no Swiss banking system anymore. It's been destroyed. And it's been destroyed by the City of London and Wall Street. They wanted to get rid of this competition. That's why they also destroyed the Frankfurt banking system and also the Luxembourg banking system and wherever it was in Europe.
Okay, how did they do that?
By blackmail. And with this whole tax evasion thing. And what have, you know, America blackmailed Switzerland to give in to all their demands, and these huge punishments, you know, for so-called tax evasion stuff. That's how they forced them to give in. I mean, there is no bank secrecy in Switzerland anymore. It's gone. It's been destroyed. And so all these typical things that was Swiss don't exist anymore. It all started when they destroyed the Swissair. You know, that was a plan to get rid, to destroy Switzerland by destroying Swissair and many other things that happened. You see, this all ties into what I said before. Any entity in the world, any country in the world that opposes or stands in the way of their imperialistic expansionist policy is destroyed, is flattened. That's what they do all the time. They've been doing this for the last 70 years.
What can you tell us about what's going to happen with the financial system? Because it does look certainly a bit shaky since 2008.
Well, shaky? That's understatement. The whole thing is such a huge bubble that can burst at any second. I mean, you see what happened. I predicted 2007, I predicted 2008 because of the information I had at the time, and also because I could count one and one is two. I mean, I could connect the dots, and I saw that this was not sustainable. And then it actually happened with the Lehman Brothers crash and all the other things. And we have not learned a lesson from that. You see, what happened was is that banks were all bailed out, and they pumped trillions of dollars into this whole system. We have this crazy situation that Mario Draghi, as head of the ECB, is pumping 80 billion euros into the market every month, and we have zero interest rates and even negative interest rates, like in Switzerland and in other countries, we have negative interest rates, and still the whole thing does not work.
Okay, so where are we heading then?
To a complete collapse. In a complete collapse of the financial system.
Would it be slow or sudden?
Well, it is happening already in slow motion right now. You know, it's not going to happen like a big crash and tomorrow you wake up and it's gone. It happens in slow motion. And I'm wondering anyway how they have been able to keep this system running for such a long time, because I thought it would have collapsed a long time ago. But since they're doing all these drastic steps, 80 billion euros every month into the system and negative rates. You see, they cannot keep up these negative rates and zero rates, because that means that all the pension funds, all those insurance, you know, life insurance companies, all those people who need interest because they promised this to their customers, like pension funds, life insurance, etc., they're going to go bust because they are not generating any interest with zero interest rates. So well, how are they going to keep their promises? They can't. That means all the money in the pension funds and for retirement and all that is all going to disappear.
So is there any precedent for this in the past that we can learn from?
Not really, because you see, in the past, when I say past, I mean like in the 1920s when the big Wall Street crash was and the big depression. You see, at that time, the difference is that we have these huge financial instruments, these huge, which were created, these artificial, which we call derivatives, you know, this huge derivative bubble, which has nothing to do with the real world. You see, what is happening in the financial area is that it's like a big casino where you're placing bets on everything. And I always have said, I don't understand why the financial system and the banks are not under the casino laws. Because where is the difference between betting on a horse and betting on an interest rate? There is no difference. You're betting. And that's what's happening all the time. They're betting on countries going bust, betting on companies going bust. They're betting on everything. On interest rates going up and down or whatever.
Is there anything positive coming out of all this? Do you think there's any kind of light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, what we see now with the Brexit, I think, is that people are realizing, because of also all the information which is on the internet, if they read the newspapers or watch the BBC or watch any other television news service, is people have woken up. They have woken up that this whole system is just a big lie, and that they are, that the politicians are lying all the time, and the media is lying all the time, and that they are not being told the truth about everything, about why there are wars, why banks are crashing, why they are not earning more, why they are losing their jobs, and all these things. And the people have woken up. You see, what I've noticed is that in the meantime, people in Europe, but also in America, have to have two faces. If you ask, that's why the polls before the election are wrong, because people are not telling the truth what they're really thinking. They then go into the booth and they make their cross. That's where they tell the truth. And that's why, because of Brexit, all the polls were wrong, because the people are not, they have two faces now. They are keeping their opinion to themselves and only expressing it then in the polls, in the booth where they make their cross on the paper.
Also, you're in Abkhazia. You've moved there recently. What kind of country is it? How have you found it? What is it very different? I imagine it is to Switzerland.
I could not stand anymore living in a country where I tried to change things, to improve things, to make things better, and I found out that it's impossible and that we have lost. And therefore, I was thinking, where shall I go? After all, I'm 64 years old, and I don't have that much time left, kind of, in my life cycle. And therefore, I decided, where shall I go? One of the criterias for my selecting a country was it has to be outside of the empire. It has to be outside of this Anglo-American empire. And therefore, I could not go to South America or Central America or any other, or Southern Europe or any of these places. And so I had to move east. And it happened that in 2008, when Georgia attacked South Ossetia and Abkhazia, I did this war reporting about this war in 2008. You know, on the 8th of August, on the day the Olympics in Peking started, Georgia attacked South Ossetia. And this is how I became aware of this country, of the Republic of Abkhazia. And I did an interview with the foreign minister, and at the end of the interview with him, he invited me to come to Abkhazia, and then a year later I came over and I visited the country, and then I was totally astounded because I've never heard of it before and didn't even know it existed. And then I saw that Abkhazia is kind of a mixture between, is like Switzerland on the sea, if you can understand what I'm trying to say, because the mountains, the Caucasus Mountains, they look very much like the Alps, and they come out of the Black Sea. So on the coast, it's very tropical with palm trees and mandarin and lemon trees and subtropical nature. And then when you go behind, the mountains go up and it looks like Switzerland with snow-covered mountains, and the highest mountain in Europe is there, Mount Elbrus, with 5,200 meters. So this fascinated me, that I found a place that looks very similar to Switzerland, but is on the sea. It's a free country. There are not many laws here, and you know, you can do what you want. You have a lot of freedom here, and the climate is nice, and that's why I decided. And the people are very friendly. They're very hospitable. The food is good. And that's why I decided to move here.
That's Manfred Petrich. Martin, have we lost? He's saying there.
I think that's too pessimistic. We've got to carry on fighting, even if we are losing. That's the lesson of history, surely.
Thanks very much. His website there is Alice Schau and Rausch. And I'll put a link to that on thisweek.org.uk. Our sister show Dialects here at noon every Tuesday. Again, we'll be talking on next Tuesday at noon about Brexit and Big Brother from George Orwell's graveside. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5.